Welcome to Coffee Break. I'm Neil Damgaard. You have reached www.neildamgaard.com in some fashion, and we're glad you've joined us on the Coffee Break podcast today. Bob, this is another podcast and discussion on the subject of World War II, and I was thinking that there's a lot of ways to study such an event, such a cataclysmic world event like this. And, you know, we mentioned this before on one of the earlier podcasts about World War II. You could study the leaders and take that approach. You could study the war economically. You could study it spiritually, which, of course, is never far from our thinking and our worldview, is to analyze everything spiritually. There's a lot of ways to study the Second World War, and we're still on this. I'm still thinking about it. You're going to have to discipline me to bring this series to an end. I'm here with Bob Perrin from South Coast Multimedia, inc.org.com.llcc, or however all that is.
Yeah.
And Bob's not saying much today. Did you not drink your coffee yet?
I'm like a quarter of the way through. Okay. And yeah, it's just, I injured my back and I'm not in the best.
All right, I'll do the talking today, and then you can.
I'll interject.
Yeah, you can do color commentary. So I am wired up and interested in the Second World War, of course, particularly today. One of the ways one could study this is through the events. We could study Pearl Harbor. We could talk about Pearl Harbor, the Battle of the Bulge, the Normandy invasion, island hopping in the Pacific, the atomic bombs. The Russian campaign with Germany, all of these different things are fascinating aspects. The Atlantic Ocean, the war for the battle for the Atlantic, I think it's called, the battle for Britain, all of these different aspects, event by event, we could look at. But we're going to do something today that has come to my mind this weekend. I have a document. I was sent a document. That's an authentic this copy of an after-action report for a bombing run, of which there were thousands and thousands and thousands of Allied bombing runs upon Germany. And I have a friend. I'm gonna not use real names today, not because I think anybody really cares, but just because I'll feel safer substituting names. And so I'm going to tell you that I have a friend whose name is Jerry, and he's been a lifelong friend. And his father was a navigator on a B-17 during the war, and then served out his career after the war in the United States Air Force, and retired, I think, as a full colonel. So I've mentioned to you before that my neighborhood where I grew up outside of Washington, D.C., was heavily military, and this friend of mine, lifelong friend, his father was no exception, Air Force. And come to find out, he was a young navigator, and on the document that we have here, there isn't a form number, but this is clearly a standard Army Air Corps standard form that was used after every mission. And this particular mission occurred on in November, the 13th of November, 1944, and it was they were flying B-17s. This is a B-17G under item number 6. You see the aircraft type B-17G, and this B-17 was part of a mission to bomb an oil refinery, the Blechheimer. Or Blechheimer, something like that, oil refinery, which is under number 2 above. And so they were flying on this mission, and the crew of B-17 was 10 men, which is interesting to me. The airplane commander is a first lieutenant, and the co-pilot is a first lieutenant, the navigator, who is the father of my friend Jerry. Is that the name I use? Jerry, I said.
Jerry, yes.
Yeah, so Jerry's dad was the navigator, and then the bombardier is a first lieutenant, and then the engineer, the master engineer, the radio operator, the waist gunner, then tail gunner.
Mast radio. Yeah.
These are all sergeants, which is interesting because, judging by this, to be on a crew, you had to be at least a sergeant. Mm. But these are all sergeants. So there's four officers, three first lieutenants, and one second lieutenant, who is the father of my friend. And then about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sergeants, crew of 10. On the back of this document, so this document has all of the details of...
You mentioned the waist gunner and a tail gunner.
Yeah.
To round out the 10. Yeah.
So there were always two waist gunners on a B-17, and so he must have done double duty as the second radio operator or the master engineer or something. Of course, there's also a ball turret gunner that's not mentioned here. One of these guys must have been ball turret also, which is interesting. The Sperry Rand ball turret is a terrifying feature on the B-17. Do you know what that is? So on the bottom of the airplane, it was a very innovative addition in the Second World War. There is a glass ball that rotates.
Okay.
It has 250 caliber machine guns, and you had to climb down into this ball. And then it's, of course, pressurized, and but there's oxygen to it. And then they seal you up in this ball.
Mm.
And it had to be small crewmen, small statured airmen that were in that particular position to fit into this small ball. And you sort of squatted or sat and had these two massive guns between your legs sticking out into the air, and you could rotate this ball turret 360. And then also it would rotate down. So it's built by the company Sperry Rand, and it's an incredible piece of engineering. But it was probably the scariest place to be on this airplane, because any battle damage, you very well may not be able to get out.
Your glass was right out there in the open, so to speak.
Exactly. The glass was hanging out in the 30,000 feet up in the air. But it was a brilliant innovation because it could protect the bottom. Approaches to the bottom of the aircraft.
Right.
Anyway, not to go on too much about that, but that's one of the crew positions too. So my friend's father, whom I knew growing up, is the navigator on this flight. Now, the interesting thing about this flight that I read, because if you look at the back page, it's the actual report, the statement from the pilot, which I'm going to read a little bit of, at approximately 0030, which is 12:30 in the morning, on the 13th of November, 1944, en route to our target, noticed some general thunderstorm activity directly on our course and either side of it. I called the members of my crew and warned them that we would probably get some turbulent air and not to get excited. I think that's funny, the young lieutenant. Of course, this lieutenant he's probably 20 years old or something. You know, he's a young man. Not to get too excited, the bombardier and navigator were making their oxygen check every 1,000 or 1,500 feet. I was climbing my aircraft 2,500 RPMs and 30 inches to 40 inches of manifold pressure. So that's a gauge of engine performance of some kind, trying to climb over the storm. However, we entered a pretty violent part of it. The airspeed dropped dangerously to 110, 115 several times, and since I have difficulty in controlling the stability of the aircraft, I called the bombardier to open the bomb bay doors and salvo the bombs. So he's doing a bomb drop early to lighten the airplane so they can fly it. At this time, I think I should mention the fact that the artificial horizon in the ship, and I don't know what that 388 is, was particularly useless and was giving inaccurate indications.
Mm-hmm.
Before the bombardier could get his bomb bay doors open and drop his bombs, the air became smooth. So I told him to hold on to the bombs. Isn't this interesting?
Mm.
This is genuine. This is from the next day or shortly thereafter. Since the aircraft had been operating pretty violently for a while, the bombardier called the crew at 0100 to see if, so they're flying at night too, by the way, see if everyone was all right. It was at this time that we discovered that the tail gunner had bailed out, jettisoning the tail door as he went out. I immediately called my radio operator and told him to call Air Sea Rescue or the ground station. His receiver was not working well, but he continued to transmit our distress signal and the position where the tail gunner bailed out. The ground station did not answer for about 30 or 40 minutes, so I circled in the area. I used channel D on my VHF and called Mayday for several minutes, but I received no response to my call. I estimated our altitude at the time. The tail gunner bailed out, was between 16,008 and 19,000 feet, positioned 43 degrees, 58 minutes north, 5 degrees, 36 minutes east. I definitely did not give any member of the crew the order to bail out, or did I even tell them to prepare to do so. During the bad weather, our radar equipment went out, which is interesting because this is late in the war. Mm. So this B-17 has radar, which is a little unusual for the time. It's new, in other words. And since could not ascertain our position, we turned back. And First Lieutenant, Air Corps pilot, and this guy's name is signed. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a fascinating document. And I looked into this a little bit, and near as I can tell, this tail gunner was never found.
Yeah.
He wasn't captured. It's either over Italy or over southern Germany or someplace where this happens. The Alps, possibly. Who knows? And he's gone.
Yeah. Now, I was looking. The place, the flight originated in Tortorella Landing Ground in Italy.
Yes.
And the target was a Black Hammer oil refinery, but yeah. It doesn't say where that is.
It doesn't say where that is, yeah.
But, and then it says, see, they contacted, it says, either,
yeah.
And I told him to call Air Sea Rescue or the ground station.
Yeah. So maybe they were flying
over water?
Or
land.
The Adriatic, possibly, yeah. Flying into Romania. I don't know where the Black Hammer or Blechheimer or however you say that, where that, we could probably look that up and see where that oil refinery was, but. Yeah, so flying from Italy to a target not in Italy,
mm-hmm.
And there's water involved, apparently, so it's possibly over the Adriatic, and they hit this weather, and the tail gunner just scoots out.
I'm out of here.
Without orders to do so. He's scared, obviously. The plane's bouncing around, banging around. It's at night.
Oh, here we go. The tail gunner bailed out over the Adriatic.
Okay.
Believed not to have been married.
Yeah, there you go. You're right, down at the bottom,
right.
Over the Adriatic. So this poor soul is lost at sea, and isn't that sad?
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't know, there's something about this document that just captures a lot in my thinking. It's about the war, you know, how quickly your life can be gone, done. And, of course, all of these men are young men. And they're from all over. This document for our podcast listeners, they can't see the document, obviously, but you know the crew list that is put down gives the name, the rank, the serial number of the crewman, and then the address, the name of the crewman's mother or wife. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that fathers are not on here. It's they send the info to the mothers or to the wife, and only one of these two of these crewmen are married. The rest of them are all single men, and so the home address is listed. So that this was to facilitate notification, you know, of next of kin in the event of loss of a crewman, which of course this crewman was lost and never heard from again, never found apparently. Yeah, that's sad. You know, this young man, a tail gunner, jumps out of his airplane into the ocean or the sea and dies apparently, that's not so unique, but it's just an interesting encapsulation of so many different aspects of the war to me. And you know, here, think from the perspective of this pilot, he lands his plane back apparently with their bombs intact, which is sketchy to do. And he's missing a crewman. And, of course, he has to answer for the crewman.
Yeah. And they said that here, current status, all of them have RTD, which I imagine is return to duty. And then
there's no injuries.
Tail gunner is MIA.
Yeah.
He's missing
an action. He's gone. And that's just sad, this tail gunner that was from South Carolina. And but the other thing I noticed, of course, is these people are from all over the place. New Jersey, Florida, New York City. Wyoming, North Carolina, Huntsville, Alabama, Louisiana, West Virginia, Illinois, and South Carolina.
Yeah.
You know, what is it, I guess, other than the service, today people are thrown together from all over the place. Mm. There's nothing else in our society that does that, really, is there? Maybe colleges? You know, colleges, maybe big colleges, they bring people together. But it's so random. This is so random and just fascinating to me.
Yeah. And I just noticed this gentleman who was missing in action. He was one of the two that were married.
Oh, he is?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Right. He's one of the two. So his wife becomes a widow.
Yeah
that's true. I hadn't noticed that. You're absolutely right. That's sad. The date of this report is looks like it's the 8th of January. No, that can't be right.
No, it says right here November. No, I'm sorry.
13 November. Oh, the date of the mission was 13 November 44. Yeah. I just see this 1-8-44. That must be that's written on here. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, and this document is a Xerox copy, which has got a lot of that.
Yeah,
black.
There's a lot of smudging and so forth on this thing.
Difficult to read.
Yeah, so I guess why are we poring over this old document? It's a symbol to me of a lot of things related to that time, but from not to get too mystical about it, but it's just an interesting story and a sad story. These men all climb into this airplane. It doesn't say what mission this is of their unit. They're from the 15th Air Force, 99th Bomb Group, flying out of Italy on this mission, and we don't know how many missions this crew has done together. Usually it was 25 missions, and then you were done.
Mm.
And
did they normally keep the same crew together?
Of course, many people are killed, and so they're bringing replacement crewmen in all the time, but a crew stays together as long as it can, and so there's a real camaraderie built. But then they lose their tail gunner, and I just think that's just incredibly tragic. You know, over the sea, he jumps out, and you make a very good observation. He's one of the two that's married. The pilot isn't even the one that's married. The co-pilot's married, and the tail gunner is married, and so this poor. Poor lady that loses her husband and never hears from him again. Apparently, you know, it's just this is what the war was all about. The war had a lot of tragedy, of course. We've talked about that a good bit. You know, from the Allied standpoint, probably more tragedy from the Axis standpoint. But finding a document like this and poring over it for its details is a fun thing to do for people who are interested in history, I think. I've never seen a document like this before, and it's just sent to me randomly by a guy who really, the son of one of these crewmen who has no affection at all for his father. The gentleman on here that was the bombardier, he's still living. He's in his 90s, and I don't have any contact with him, obviously, but the son still has occasional contact with him. But to me, this is a thing that we ought to pay attention to. The heritage of serving our country in the Second World War, there's something unique about it to me. Not that World War II veterans are worth any more than Korean War veterans or Afghanistan veterans. I'm not saying that. But I thought, you know, this is the kind of stuff that it seems to me we ought to remember.
Yeah.
So the B-17G, of course, was the last, I think the last model of that aircraft used during the war. A great aircraft, by the way. And then there are pictures, you've probably seen them too, of boneyards out west, you know, Wyoming, Nevada, places like that, where there's thousands of these used to be left sitting. They fly them all back home and stick them out in the desert, and there they sat, and finally they get cut up for scrap. But anyway, I've always been interested in the B-17. I had the husband of a cousin that flew 72 missions as a pilot of B-26 Marauder. And I didn't even know that until fairly recently. My cousin is 92, and she's a sprightly, wonderful woman, lives in Florida, but she told me that her husband, her late husband, flew 72 missions. And she very deliberately said to me, a B-26 Marauder, Neil. Mm. She knew exactly what he flew in, you know. Yeah. So anyway, just an interesting topic to think about, and then sort of, okay, jumping over to the Christian standpoint. To me, I wanted to ask you the question, do you think patriotism is a Christian-fueled virtue?
Patriotism, yes. Nationalism, no.
And what do you see the difference as?
Well, yeah, I got to make sure my definition is acceptable to everyone. I would say patriotism is having a pride, and not a sinful pride, but a pride in your country, in your nation, in your people. And nationalism is taking that to the extreme where you think that your nation may well indeed be better than other nations as far as, you know, everything you rate what's better on. My nation has the right to exist more than this nation does, or my nation is superior just because of the way it is.
So would you say, you know, that an English subject of the Queen should be patriotic to his or her monarch?
It depends.
On whether the monarch is a righteous monarch or not? A godly, just, truly biblically justice-minded monarch? This is where it gets complicated to me, because sometimes we, as evangelical Christians, we sort of equate patriotism with godliness.
Yeah. There was an expression popular 20, 30 years ago, maybe longer, America, love it or leave it. And on the surface, that sounds like a great thing, and maybe back in the day, that was an appropriate...
The World War II day?
Yeah. Maybe that was an appropriate... is that when that originated?
I think that's much later.
Yeah.
That sounds like a 1970s.
Yeah, it sounds like a Vietnam era thing. But that's really, you know, John F. Kennedy, that's not what you can do for you.
What your country can do for you.
But yeah, that's what you can do for you. And to me, that's just the opposite. Okay? Hmm. I mean, I could do things for my country and serve my country, but my country doesn't own me. I own my country. I own my government. I'm the boss of those clowns in office, as you are, as every citizen is. And so there's a... So to answer your question, is patriotism
Christian-fueled virtue?
It can be, but it also cannot be. When you boil it all down, I am not a citizen of the United States. I'm a citizen of Christ's kingdom first.
First. And you happen to be in God's providence, right, to have been born in this country.
Right. And I'm happy about that. I don't, you know, even still I'm happy with the misdirection for the past,
right,
X number of years that this country's been, you know, going down the tubes. I'm still grateful to be a born and raised in this country.
As am I. Yeah. So, but it's an interesting question because that I think about, because I think about this document that we're looking at and all that the Second World War has meant in my own life. My life is completely colored by having been raised by a veteran that was very much marked by not only the war itself, but by the cause of patriotism and serving the government in a civil servant way. And my life is very much tempered by those values. And yet, I think, you know, is that Christian or is that just circumstantial? I happen to have been born here. I was raised, you know, the United States is thought to be virtuous and noble and honorable in its cause to defeat the Axis, which was plainly evil. I mean, there's, I don't know, you can make a case for German patriotism coming out of the First World War and how they were, you could make a case they were, you know, stripped of all dignity in the Treaty of Versailles. And then Nazism is just a reaction to being poorly handled after World War One. You could make that case, and then therefore German citizens were sort of marching to the in lockstep, literally, to nationalism.
Right, and America had the wisdom to see that, and you know that's when the whole lend-lease thing started and everything with trying to help Germany out of that, because we saw that. It was the other allies. It was the
Britain and France, that were very much. Of course, World War One was such an incredibly terrible thing, and such a strange war to me. And I've said this on previous podcasts that I think that. But you know, we're sitting here sort of in the seat of righteousness with World War Two, and we think that way. But I think about in over history, if you know, is a patriotism for. In China, if they felt, if you're a Chinese citizen or a Chinese business person, merchant, 500 years ago, and you felt patriotic towards the dynasty, the emperor, whoever it is that's in place, you know, of course they didn't have Christians in China, I don't think, so much in 1500. The gospel's not there so much yet, but is patriotism automatically a good thing? I guess is what I'm aiming at. And we would almost say, of course it is, because we're righteous people. Mm. But we've done a lot of unrighteous things, too.
Right.
A lot of slip-ups.
Yeah. I think, generally speaking, patriotism is a good thing, even if you're patriotic toward a nation that... I mean, these are your people.
Yeah. Okay. And loyalty to your people. I think about the Apaches.
Yeah.
You know, I've been fascinated by the Apache chief, Cochise. Mm-hmm. And I've read a great deal about him, his family, the Apache Wars, the attempt by the government, the United States government, to bring peace, and that whole period of history in the 1870s. And if you're an Apache citizen, and these interlopers come, and all they do is take your land and then make treaties and break them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's us we're talking about.
Right.
And you're an Apache person. How impressed are you going to be with American patriotism?
Not very.
Not very. And, of course, they're utterly annihilated.
Yeah.
You know, but...
And there are things we certainly can be ashamed of in our history, and even, maybe even currently. You know, it's tough when Christians are called upon by their nation to combat other Christians. That's a real toughie for me.
Yeah, I agree.
And you know, that certainly that happened in World War One and World War Two,
or the Civil War.
In the Civil War, okay.
But let's not even go there.
In recent history, in the Clinton administration, when we were in Bosnia, I mean, we were fighting with the Muslims against
the Serbs.
The Serbs,
who were the genocidal crazy guys.
Yeah, but they were Christians also,
quote unquote.
Supposedly, yeah. So, I mean, you get
Slobodan Milosevic. Yeah. I always love to say his name.
Say that 10 times fast. Not now. Just do it later. and it's tough. You know, yeah, I mean, it's getting harder and harder. It's getting harder and harder to have a good war nowadays. It really is.
Because it's not black and white, and evil and good are so muddied by political definitions and economics. I mean, the whole economics of oil.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not impressed by the socialist arguments that we shouldn't care about who has the oil. We mentioned this before. Mm-hmm. You know, and I thought, really? You know, you really don't care about economics? You really just think we should all, you know, that's pretty naive.
Yeah. But there is a truth, I think, anyway, my limited knowledge of this topic. When you have, like, the Chinese so invested in the United States and the businesses and stuff like that, when you have that kind of
intertwining of the, I'm not afraid of China attacking us or Russia attacking us. I think it's going to be some whack job with a suitcase bomb, you know, who's getting 70 virgins. He thinks he's getting 70 virgins when he dies.
This podcast has started off really about this document, this after-action report from one mission, one airplane, one mission, one crew during the Second World War, but as a sort of an illustration of some of the details associated with a cause that we would say, I would say, was pretty righteous. Mm-hmm. The defeat, I mean, we, the United States, Britain, France, Poland, Australia, New Zealand, these were the countries of the, these were the Allies, Canada. Mm-hmm. You know, we weren't on a great crusade to take over the world. Mm-hmm. The Third Reich and Imperial Japan were. Mm-hmm. And the Third Reich, for probably a little bit darker reasons, the Imperial Japanese Army and Navy were pretty ruthless, pretty terribly atrocity-driven ruthlessness, but their cause was a little different than the Third Reich, which was absolute domination. Right. And we were not about that. We were about defending against a clear and plain evil.
Ann Coulter wrote, you know who she is, she
yes,
wrote an article,
columnist, yes.
A couple of days ago, Are We the New Neville Chamberlain?
I read that.
Yeah.
I actually read that
yeah.
editorial, yes.
And I think she was spot on.
She was. She's very intuitive on this. Yeah, we are. We're about appeasement and about peace at any price, and they can do anything they want. You know, as we do this podcast today, it's on a Monday, and this weekend there was yet another massive attack in Pakistan targeting Christians, although I read this morning that most of the 70 deaths were Muslims.
Really?
Yes. Collateral deaths. That it's just sad. Mm-hmm. The intent was to target Christians on Easter Sunday by the Taliban, mm-hmm. and but a lot of Muslims were killed who happened to be in the same place.
Yeah.
And so many of our politicians are about appeasing that force.
Yeah,
I don't know how to defeat that force either. I'm not smart enough, but boy, it sure seems like, well, let's just let them have their way, and you know.
And for the listeners who might not know who Neville Chamberlain was, he was the Prime Minister of England before Winston Churchill.
And during the time of the beginning of World War II, when
actually met with Hitler and tried to, you know, smooth things over, and
and he goes down in history as probably as the appeaser, you know, and that whole school of thought, which is very popular today. Mm-hmm. So okay, this has been Coffee Break Podcast. We're wrapping up a 4-session series on the Second World War. We'll move on to other stuff soon, but we're glad you joined us. Please interact with us. I'm with Bob Perrin, South Coast Multimedia, and we have been exploring all kinds of different subjects for coming on 2 years. In June will be 2 years.
2 years, wow.
Yeah, I sure have enjoyed our affiliation, Bob, and all the kinds of things we're talking about. So thanks for joining us on Coffee Break. We're on iTunes. We're on the internet. My website is www.neildamgard.com. And
my website is www.southcoastmultimedia.com.
Okay. I keep messing that up, don't I?
Yeah.
That's okay. So communicate with us, interact with us, and join us again.